Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm a host for the New Books and History Channel. My name is Christine Lamberson, and today I'll be speaking with two authors, David Silby and Kenneswaran Wantri Chennalai, and we'll be discussing their new edited volume titled Wars, Civil and Great, The American Experience in the Civil War and World War I. It came out last year with the University of Kansas Press. Welcome, David and Kenneswaran, and thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So this book is an edited collection drawing connections and comparison between the Civil War and World War I, here called the Great War, because it was called the Great War at the time. And this is a really unique book. And in particular, what is unique and unusual about this is the periodization. As your book points out, it might not have seemed so unusual to be talking about the Civil War during the actual period of the Great War. But at this point, now in the present day, usually historians think of these wars separately, or they talk about these wars separately. We have Civil War historians who are talking about the Civil War within the context of the 19th century often. People who are talking about the Great War are usually talking about it within the context of the 20th century. We much more frequently hear historians talking about World War I and World War II in conversation with each other, rather than talking about these two wars in conversation with each other. So I want to spend a little bit of time as we get started talking about why this book is valuable and why this comparison makes sense. So to start, I thought we would talk a little bit about each of your historical backgrounds and your historical expertise and the perspective you're bringing to this project. And then after doing that, we'll talk a little bit more about the project specifically. So David, could you start by telling us about your background and how you identify as a historian, so to speak, and how you got interested in the topics that you study?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for having us on today. It's a wonderful opportunity to chat about the book and about history in general. I label myself as a historian of total war, and I really try to focus on the period from the American Civil War to the end of World War II, because I think that's really the era when war becomes this all-encompassing, industrialized, mass nationalistic endeavor that really dominates the world in a way that it hadn't before or really since. Within that, I've sort of focused on a variety of different conflicts. But one of the things that I always thought was that we tend to think of the Civil War as a war that ends an era or a war that transitions from one era to another. And we neglect it and sort of pay more attention to the Industrial Revolution and the rise of great navies and great armies. And that always seemed to me to be very problematic. And so when we sort of started thinking about this, one of the joys of being able to work on this project was that it really started to knit together the whole era that I study, rather than have it be the two world wars and everything else.
Great. Thank you. Kenneswaran, let's turn to you.
Well, so I'm an historian of the 19th century, of the 19th century United States. And I guess I got involved or interested in that time period by getting into the Civil War. And I started with an interest in the military history of the Civil War, but then really expanded to be interested in the social and cultural aspects of that conflict. And I think what drew me to this project, or why this seemed appealing, is that when I was working on my dissertation and my first monograph, Northern Character, many of the individuals that I studied, and by the way, it's a study of college-educated New Englanders who fought in the American Civil War, many of them lived on into the 20th century and were elderly by the time of the Great War, but they certainly thought about it and wrote about it. And there's also this other moment when I was in high school, actually, when I first started getting interested in the American Civil War, and I read Jeff Shara's book, The Last Full Measure, and it's the third part of the Killer Angel series that Michael Shara, his father, Jeff's father, started. And won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1970s. And in The Last Full Measure, it ends with one of the characters, the primary characters from the whole series, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, dying in 1914. And Shara then talks about how just a few months later, war breaks out in Europe and they have not learned anything. And so I think the seed for this project was planted a very long time ago, and then was able to sort of grow and reach fruition thanks to David, a comment that David made, and then his willingness to take this project on with us.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit more maybe about that comment that David made, and I'm curious for you to tell the origin story of this book specifically. And I'll here tell our listeners, full disclosure, that I used to work with Conna Sorin at Angelo State University at the moment, perhaps when this project got started, and so have a small bit part, or at least was around during the origin of this project. So I'll turn it over to you to tell that story.
This is a project that started after we had done 4 years of a series to mark the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War. We put on public lectures for folks in the San Angelo area, and we used talents from the faculty at Angelo State and area schools and universities. And when we were done with that in 2015, we started looking around to see what else we could do to continue this momentum of having a public history lecture series. And thanks to the National Endowment for the Humanities, thanks to Christine, to your hard work in helping to get that grant for Angelo State, we were able to bring in scholars from around the country to visit San Angelo and talk about the Great War at its centennial moment, to bring to life this conflict that very few people thought about, knew about, or realized that it was the 100th anniversary of. And I think, David, you were our first visitor from another campus. And while you were on stage, you made some comment about how General Sir Douglas Haig had to contend with some of the same issues that General Ulysses Grant had to deal with during the Civil War. And that was an intriguing comment to me. And then after the program, you and I talked about the other ways in which the conflicts were related, and that's how I remember it starting.
Yeah, now and that's absolutely right. There's even more of a backstory to it, because whenever I go to audiences in the South, I'm always deeply suspicious about their sympathies in the Civil War, and often paranoid that I'm in a nest of Confederates. So there I am, deep in the heart of Texas, and I have an unfortunate habit of poking people a little bit. Sometimes verbally, as my daughter will tell you, sometimes physically. And in this case, I was talking about World War I, and I wanted to sort of poke the audience a little bit. And how better to do that than harass them with a mention of U.S. Grant, the single greatest general of the American Civil War, and someone who they might react to not so well. So I'm entertaining myself, I guess is the way I would put it, in front of the audience. And I said it, and there was a certain amount of reaction, but Texas is sort of its own nation anyway. So I don't think I got them as much as I was hoping. When kids sort of later said, you know, that was an interesting comment, and I sort of confessed that I had been being snarky, I guess is the current phrase, We did then just start talking about it because it's this interesting conundrum that there is such a divide between these two conflicts. The other thing I'd mention, and Kit, I don't know if I've ever told you this, is as a historian, as a scholar, you sort of end up with more ideas than you have time to do. My advisor used to compare them to having airplanes circling the runway. You can only land one airplane at a time. And I'd long had this idea that the leaders of the great armies in total war, Grant, Haig, Pershing, Zhukov in World War II for the Soviets, had similar characteristics or were seen in similar ways and subject to similar pressures. And so when Kid and I started talking about this, it was really a moment of, wait, I can land this plane. I can bring this one in. And more than that, it'll be part of this larger effort. So it's one of those things that sort of fit into the larger professional thing of being a historian, where you have stuff you want to do and finding a moment and a project to do them in is often as difficult as actually doing the topic.
Happy to find runway space for this, David.
Absolutely.
That's great. Well, thank you for giving us that background. And as you say, there's lots of value in making these comparisons. David, you just mentioned one set of comparisons, which becomes the heart of the essay that you contribute to this volume. And I want to talk a little bit more about that in a second. But before we get there, maybe you guys could tell us a little bit about why these two wars aren't in conversation as often. Maybe if we could just take a step back from the volume and think about, why does the profession have this kind of separation, or why do we typically make the separation between these two wars specifically?
Kid, do you want to take a shot at the Civil War?
I'm going to blame World War II. I'm going to say that World War II was such a defining and all-encompassing moment in the 20th century that all else is compared to it, that everything gets sucked into its vortex and is in its shadow, including World War I. Now, the question is, what was education like? What was history education like between right after the end of the Great War and before World War II broke out? Did the Civil War loom larger? I guess that's another topic we could have considered or thought about as to what people were learning at that time. But I think that World War II, the Great Depression and World War II were such defining characteristics of the 20th century that, I mean, everything else just paled in comparison to that. My guess is that David will have a broader perspective on this.
Well, I think I'm going to build on what you just said, which is United States, Americans don't like World War I. You know, we get into the war late. The war ends really before we're fully engaged. And then after it ends, all of this messiness starts happening. Lenin releases the secret treaties and lots of other very embarrassing documents for the American side. Wilson has a stroke and the U.S. doesn't ratify the Treaty of Versailles. And there's this sense almost immediately that this was a mistake. This was old Europe. We're the new world. We don't want to. Why did we get involved in this? And so World War I sort of gets forgotten, I think, almost right away. And then, as Kid mentioned, World War II comes along and World War I becomes an adjunct to World War II. It stops being the Great War and is now the First World War, except the Second World War for the U.S. is the good war. This is the one we like. We were definitely on the side of righteousness. We were the good guys. And so World War I is seen as, in a pre-Vietnam era, I think, as the bad war, the war that we really don't want to pay that much attention to. And to this day, I don't think the U.S. thinks in its public memory nearly as much about World War I as it does World War II. Until very recently, there was no memorial to World War I, no national memorial. And there still isn't one on the Mall. You know, there's the giant World War II memorial on the Mall, but nothing, but the World War I monument is off in downtown DC. And so if you think about the wars that Americans think about as part of our history, it's the Revolution, the Civil War, World War II, and Vietnam. And all the other wars are sort of put in the shadow by that. So you don't, the Civil War is its own subject, and World War I is never really brought into that conversation.
Can I just add that, I mean, that's a really good point there at the end about the aftermath and how it sours people and the memory of the conflict. Now, the Civil War survives as a pinnacle moment, but Reconstruction does not. No one really wants to talk about Reconstruction. Yeah, and that's the messier part for many Americans. It's also probably more important than the 4 years of the war itself. Reconstruction lasts 12 years. It's a great experiment in American democracy. There are three constitutional amendments that are passed. It's a really important time for national reform. But it is marred by many factors, memory, the lost cause, the loss of civil rights, ultimately, as a result of the return of democratic governments to the seceded states. And also, here's another parallel between these two conflicts that we write about, which is that the nation loses strong leadership. And at the end of both these conflicts, Lincoln's assassinated, the first president to be assassinated, successfully assassinated. And then, of course, Wilson suffers a stroke. And so there are these parallels, too, between the two conflicts that perhaps explain some of why the aftermath of the memory of the conflicts is not as well remembered as some other others in our history.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I'd even add further to that. Reconstruction almost succeeds in helping the Civil War become a well-remembered war around the country because of reconciliation, because of the idea of reconciliation and the South and the North reintegrating. And we're going to push aside all the messiness that we were actually fighting about slavery and things like that. And instead, it's all about, brother against brother and coming back together. And that's a much easier kind of war to remember, where everybody was a good guy in our memory, than the sort of real messiness of it.
Well, following along from what you were just saying, David, if I may, your explanation of why these are often not put in conversation makes a lot of sense for both of you. But thinking about the essential character of the Civil War versus the character of World War One, these two conflicts are really quite different. Of course, a Civil War versus a war in Europe, one with it's entirely involving Americans, one where Americans get in sort of light and have a smaller role. All of these kinds of things are differences. So I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about what we learn and why it's important to put these wars together in conversation. Obviously, starting with a question like, what do we learn from putting them in conversation? That's your entire book, so I don't expect you to answer that succinctly right now in a few sentences. But if you could just give us an idea of what, why they should be put in conversation. And one way to do that might be to talk a little bit about some of the opening important questions that you start the volume with and that you presented to the contributors for their essays.
So that's a really good question. And a couple things occur to me that are ways of thinking about why comparing the two wars is really useful. One is that we tend to think of the Civil War as a single conflict. And I would actually argue that one of the things you discover when you look at it with World War One as a comparison is that there's a much different experience of the Civil War in late 1864 and into 1865. And when we're talking about the siege of Petersburg and the trench systems that were built up around there, that looks a lot more like World War One than earlier at Gettysburg or at Antietam. But we don't think about it. And so putting the two wars together gives us a chance to understand that the Civil War ended much differently than it began and makes us think more carefully about the Civil War. The second thing, and this is sort of highlights some of the questions that we asked our contributors, is that the wars were in conversation at the time the First World War happened. That is, it's a conversation that had already happened and was happening. And so we're not starting necessarily with something completely new. We're reestablishing something that was going on. The military getting ready for World War One thought about what had happened in the Great War, in the Civil War. There were people who were alive for both. There were people, interestingly enough, who served in both conflicts, which is kind of an impressive achievement. And so the people at the time would very much have been thinking about the Civil War and the Great War together. And one of the points of this book and one of the things we asked our contributors was, how did that work? How did people at the time of the Great War think about what was going on in the Civil War, and what lessons did they bring forward from that conflict?
Woodrow Wilson, especially. He is a student of history. He has a PhD in history and political science. He studied the Civil War, and certainly he and his officials are looking at, how do we run a national draft? How do we prevent riots from taking place again? How do we mobilize the people, the population? I think David's spot on. I'll just add that part of what drew me to this is also the opportunity to study something that we always say in sort of an experimental setting. You always say, learn from history. Well, how do you learn from history? And how did other people learn from history? How did the Great War generation learn from the Civil War? What lessons did they take from it? What if they learned the wrong lessons? What if they learned the right lessons? What if they didn't think there were any lessons to learn? Right? So here we can see how they interpreted how the Civil War era, Civil War generation fought their conflict, applied those ideas, and then we get to see whether or not they succeed or failed and what are the consequences of that. So on a bigger level, it's an opportunity to look at how people learn from history and whether or not they take the right lessons from it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the things I think is so valuable is the point that you've both mentioned, the fact that many people experienced both of these conflicts or remembered them, or at least grew up hearing about them, even if they couldn't quite remember the Civil War themselves. They might have had parents who were involved in it or remembered it, etc. And one of the challenges of studying history and teaching history is helping us now and continue to remember that lived experience, that people do not experience history the way that we write about it. And you're kind of bringing some of that experience back to the conversation and helping us understand those lessons, as you say. I think the book does a great job of doing that.
The other thing, I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing to think about, I think, that builds off of what you just mentioned, is that as we're discovering now with the Civil War, history is never permanently settled. History is never written in stone. It's always being remade. It's always a live political issue, a cultural issue. And so the people who were thinking about World War One, even if they weren't in the military, even if they weren't part of that effort, they were inevitably thinking about the Great War, the Civil War. You know, the 1913 is the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg, and there's a giant reunion on the battlefield in Gettysburg. So at the very moment that storm clouds are just beginning to gather in Europe, the U.S. is riveted by news stories about the remembrances reunion at Gettysburg, and it was played as reconciliation. So it's that moment of, we're going to think about this war at the same time that we're watching what's going on. The other thing I'd mention is the two conflicts in American history where the main army of the United States fought the main army of its enemy were primarily the Civil War and the Great War. We can talk about the American Revolution, and by that I mean similar size enemies. I'm not counting things like the Mexican-American War. But so World War I and the Civil War were actually unique experiences to a large degree. In a way that almost no other war in American history has actually had the same level. The only exception that I would mention is the Pacific War in World War II. And so these are unique moments in American military history and unique wars. And it's almost malpractice not to compare them to each other, because you got to understand what that uniqueness means in a larger sense for the entirety of U.S. military history.
Okay, I want to turn now to talking about some of the individual essays within this volume. And in some ways on these podcasts, it can be difficult to talk about an edited volume because we won't have time to talk about every article. And I just kind of want to give our listeners a taste. But to start, I'm just going to give a very, very quick summary of the topics that are covered within the volume. You all focus on the American side of things, and this is not primarily a military history in the sense of talking about individual battles. But you do talk about military leadership. You talked about political leadership. You have contributors who talk about African-American soldiers' experiences of the war. You talk about the home front and questions about loyalty and power on the home front. There are histories of medicine and changes of the medical field and surgery and treatment of veterans and injuries. There's a discussion of mental trauma, an environmental history of the war, discussion of veterans, and a discussion of memory. So with that overview, I wanted to talk a little bit about each of your own essays in some more detail, and then talk perhaps about some of the things that you all learned from this. So David, if we could start with your essay about generals, and you've already hinted a little bit about this when you talked about the origins of this project, but could you tell our listeners a little bit about some of the major generals, the generals that you talk about in this book, obviously, and what was different in particular about these generals and make them interesting and illuminating to understand these conflicts?
Yeah, I think they were the very models of modern major generals. So that was one of the things that attracted to me. One of the things that attracted me to this, or that I started thinking about in terms of military leadership, is that the leaders in the generals in the Civil War and the Great War had responsibility at a level beyond any American general before or after them, I think. Certainly U.S. Grant is the, whatever you think of his quality, the most important general in just about all of American military history, because he was really the one who waged war against Lee's Army of Northern Virginia and ended up defeating it. And by doing so, breaking the back of the Confederacy. And so he had a level of responsibility by himself that very few other American generals had. And that gave him an interestingly unique position. John J. Pershing, the American general who commanded the expeditionary force in World War I, didn't have quite that level of responsibility. He was part of an allied force. There were generals superior to him in the field, but he was still in that sort of large scale responsibility, the first and biggest American force to be sent abroad, with the exception of the Spanish-American War, in a way that represented the United States. I did cheat, I'll be honest, by bringing not only Pershing in as a comparison, but General Sir Douglas Haig of the British Army, because he in many ways occupied the same position as Grant did in the Civil War, where he was the head of the almost entire British fighting effort, and had the kind of responsibility that very few British generals had before or since. And I wanted to look at what being in that position meant to a general, where you are the war effort in some very symbolically important ways. And how did people react to that? How did you react to that? How did the commander in chief, the president, react to that? Because I think it tells us a lot about how we think about conflicts and how we think about generals and how we think about leadership.
Mm-hmm. One other thing you talk about in your essay is not just how we think about conflicts and leadership, but how we think about these wars. And these generals become closely identified with their war specifically and become a part of the memory, so to speak. And in fact, the final essay talks about two of them again. And in the final essay that is talking about memory of these two wars. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about how they come to be so closely identified with the war? Or maybe another way, a slightly different variation of that question would be, what is the effect of their close identification with their war?
Yeah, I think human beings like to personalize things. I think we like to understand large, complex topics by identifying them with a person. It's psychologically comforting. And so one of the things that happens is that these war efforts, these ungodly, complex, enormous, entire nation demanding efforts come to be located in the shape of a particular person. At the political level in the Civil War, that was Lincoln, but in the military level, it came to be Grant. And so they came to be seen both during the war and after as the avatars of this war. And almost all of the positives and negatives of the wars themselves were then located in the positives and negatives of that person. Grant comes to be seen as the symbol of the enormous bloodletting that happened during the Civil War, where it's not just something that's going to happen in this kind of industrial mass war. It's his fault. He's the butcher of the Civil War. And that then feeds into the way we remember the war and even the way we memorialize the war with the monuments we create to them, where in the Great War, for example, Douglas Haig's monument is located so close to the monument in London, to the monument of the dead of the war, that there's actually a political outcry. It was his fault that they were dead. How could you put that monument so close together? And so it's this sort of fascinating personalization of the conflicts that lasts before and during and after the conflicts. There's even it happens in little ways and sort of strange little ways. Grant was famously a cheerful guy. He liked to tell jokes. He liked to play with his kids. He would take his sons with him around to the various headquarters he was at. And yet that's not the way we remember him. We think of him as this dour, unemotional guy, because I think it's hard to identify him with the war and think of him as this cheerful, happy guy. Now, I don't want to overstate that, but there is this way in which he has to have a personality that would fit the war, because the war was so awful, he can't be seen to be cheerful. And so we even rewrite how we perceive who the person was to make them fit the war that they were fighting.
Mm-hmm. And Pershing, of course, is in many ways probably the least known for Americans, which very much tracks with the overall forgetting, in quotes, of World War One for many Americans.
Yeah, and I think it goes along with the forgetting of World War One itself. Pershing comes back, and for a moment, there's this fascinating moment where there's this argument that he should be nominated by both parties for the presidency in 1920, that he has won the war for America and he should be president by acclaim. But very rapidly thereafter, he sort of disappears from from public view. He writes a two-volume memoir that is some of the worst prose you'll ever encounter in any book you've ever read. But he sort of is then subsumed by World War II and by, you know, much more lastingly famous generals like MacArthur and Eisenhower and folks like that. He is, it's fascinating because he's still an iconic figure to those generals themselves. So Eisenhower visits him in Washington fairly frequently. MacArthur does as well before he dies in 1948. And so he's still this great icon to the community within the military, but he's sort of very much forgotten by the United States.
Another line about memory there and how personas and how reputations shift and change very rapidly over time. Pershing does hold a really important distinction, David, which you'd love to tell people about.
He is the only person in American military history who's held the rank of, which one is it, General of the Armies? His rank is General of the Armies. Grant's rank was General of the Army, singular. And so Pershing has the sort of unique title or unique rank that doesn't exist for anyone else. That's, you're killing me, kid, because that's such a fascinating little sort of nugget. Is the only other people who have, the only person who has a higher rank than Pershing and Grant is George Washington. And he only has that because they retroactively gave it to him at the Bicentennial in 1976, and also said he will, Washington will forever be senior to every other general in American military history. So there's this sort of fascinating memorialization and remembrance going on in how Congress and the people rank their military figures. But Christine, to go back to your original point, if you asked an American school child to name the highest ranking American generals, I think they'd have a pretty good shot at getting Washington and Grant. I can't imagine that anybody would remember Pershing.
I agree. That seems very, very unlikely. Can you tease this out, explain a little bit more? Why does he have this rank? Can you explain the military aspect there?
So there are normally the highest rank a general can have is to have 4 stars. Sort of famous 4-star generals are the highest ranking folks. Occasionally, when someone does something massively impressive or is part of a massively war winning effort, they can be given a 5-star rank. So the first real one who's given a 5-star rank was Grant in the Civil War, if I'm remembering correctly. As part of the celebration of the victory of the Civil War, Grant was promoted to 5 stars. And when Pershing came back, he from World War I, the U.S. was triumphant in that first flush of victory and celebration. Congress voted him to be a 5-star general as well. Where it gets really messy is in World War II, because there are all these generals who are responsible for triumphs in different areas. And how to put this politely, levels of rivalry with each other. So as soon as Congress starts promoting one person to 5-star, they also have to start promoting other people. And so we come out with a range of 5-star generals from the Second World War: MacArthur, Eisenhower, Hap Arnold of the Army Air Force, so they're all sort of, you know, maneuvering around each other, and we haven't had one since. The other part of this is what title they actually get to call themselves. And so Grant is General of the Army, and the implication was won the war, and then They don't make Pershing the same thing. They make him general of the armies to sort of distinguish that. And it's a unique title that I don't believe will ever be used again in American military history. We're just not fighting wars at that scale anymore. Knock on wood.
Right, right. Hopefully. Okay, let's shift and pivot to talking about the more rank and file soldiers, and Connoisseur, and talking about your essay about veterans' treatment in American society. You also have an essay about the home front, but let's talk about veterans since we're on that topic. So how do these wars work together to shape veterans' treatment in American society? You're really telling a tale both of contrast, but then also of a longer trajectory that brings us all the way up to the present to some extent.
Well, so on the matter of veterans, this is one of those lessons that the Great War generation did not take the right lesson from the Civil War. So this is one of those paths that they should not have walked down. But the reason for them doing it was understandable. So pensions had never really been a big deal in American history. That is to say, relying on a mostly volunteer force for its history, the United States never really had the budget nor cared to increase its budget in order to pay for pensions until the Civil War. The Civil War was such a massive expansion of the military. It called on millions of Americans from all walks of life. And there was such devastation. I mean, tens of thousands of Americans returned home with horrible injuries. They lacked limbs. They could not go to work. They needed help and all that. And the military, the government, the Lincoln government, was, of course, very grateful. And Grant's government, too, himself, having been the commander of all these troops during the war, were very grateful for the service of these individuals. Add to that the fact that veterans represented a really critical component of the voting bloc for the Republican Party during Reconstruction and the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era afterwards. And you have this combination of forces that helped to create really the first pension system for veterans in United States history. It's, of course, only for United States veterans, those who fought to preserve the Union. Those who fought for the Confederacy were not eligible for this, and that's why there was this divide in Congress where Democrats, who at the time drew their strength from the Southern states, would vote against this, and Republicans voted to increase the amount of money for veterans and pensions over the course of time. By the Progressive Era, by the time that the generation that brought Woodrow Wilson to power came into office, they looked at the federal budget. They saw that the largest expenditure was pensions. I mean, we spent $3 billion on pensions, more than the cost of the Civil War itself. And they saw this as so wasteful that there was there's potential for fraud. These veterans were, in some of their terms, weren't doing anything else to contribute to the nation anymore. They saw it as a problem of dependence. They didn't want that. That didn't fit with the idea of American masculinity at the time. So there was this pushback against the Civil War veterans, saw them as in essence living off the government without doing anything. And so when Wilson's government put in place a plan for the returning doughboys, they said, well, we're going to make sure that these returning troops are set up to take care of themselves after the war is over. We won't do any pensions. They'll be going on with their lives. We won't add to the federal budget. We will have solved the problem. They saw the pensions as a mistake from the Civil War era. Now, the doughboys came back and they looked around and they saw that those who had not gone to war had actually benefited by the booming economy. And they said, well, maybe we could just get a little bit of money, not as a pension, but sort of to bring equalize the economic scales for us. And there was this huge debate in Congress. Two presidents vetoed the bill to provide a bonus for the veterans, Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Congress eventually passes this bill over the veto of Calvin Coolidge, saying that they're going to pay the World War I veterans, the Great War veterans, a bonus in 1945. 1932 comes along, the Great Depression hits, the veterans are hit harder because they have less to fall back upon financially than those who had stayed on the home front during the war, and they ask for their benefits early. That leads to the bonus March that leads to this riot that sinks Herbert Hoover's reputation, ushers in Franklin Roosevelt into office, one of the factors that allowed for Roosevelt to sweep in during that election. And come World War II, what is Roosevelt looking at? He's looking at the example of World War I and Wilson. It's like, well, where did they go wrong? Well, how about cutting pensions as being a mistake? We don't want the bonus marchers to come back. We don't want this problem again. So that leads to the creation of the GI Bill, which many will argue was responsible for the booming economy in the 1950s and 1960s. So the big lesson you take from learning the wrong lesson from history is you have to relearn.
Yeah, it's interesting to end up with this sort of pendulum swing back and forth on the treatment of veterans there. And since then, of course, it's interesting, too, that the pensions themselves perhaps have been a little bit more consistent, though this is not my precise area of expertise. But the larger public opinion about veterans and the kind of appreciation of service and things like that has continued to vacillate depending on the particular war and historical moments and particular lessons. Those two things have perhaps become a little bit more divorced from each other.
One of the, just to follow on a little bit, one of the fascinating things is the way in which the pensions make Civil War veterans valuable economic assets. They have income for life and income that passed on to their widow when they died. And so there was actually a sort of very strong tendency to marry very young women off to very old Civil War veterans in the 20s and 30s to sort of preserve that income stream. And I think, you know, the last Civil War pension was still being paid to an elderly widow into the 21st century. I mean, the Civil War pensions have lasted almost a century and a half, which is sort of a remarkable statement about their place in American society.
Yeah, that's right. I vaguely remember hearing about the last Civil War widow dying. And I think a lot of Americans probably were thinking, wait, what's happening with this? It's an interesting story. And as you all say, it's one of those ones that reminds us how close history really is, even when it seems so far away. So I'm also curious if perhaps each of you might talk a little bit about something that you learned that was really unexpected from other contributors in this volume. I was thinking a little bit about how to talk about some of the other really wonderful essays, even though we're not bringing those authors into this podcast interview, and thought that perhaps you two could each pick out a few things, one thing, two things that stood out to you as particularly interesting and unexpected and revelatory as you were doing the editing process. And let's start with you again, David.
The one that strikes me is the one on in the environmental history of the trenches and the siege around Petersburg by Brian Allen Drake, which is a sort of new kind of history for me. When I graduated from, got my PhD, environmental history was really just barely beginning. And so it was sort of a fascinating experience to read his essay as we were editing it and come to understand the trench system around Petersburg almost as its own ecology, its own environment, in a way that I'd never really thought about before. It's one of the great new innovations in history, and that is environmental history is one of these great new approaches. And it really, I think, helps us think about wars and the military in this much different way. I mean, I think one of the points Brian makes is the way in which Petersburg, the trench system, resembled its own city, with a population, with living areas, with, you know, sewer systems or, you know, systems for taking care of hygiene. And sort of thinking about that gives you, for me at least, gave me a much better sense of the scale of what was going on and just the demands both on the people but also on the nature and the world around the trench systems that were so deeply affected by the war.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really liked how that essay started. He mentioned that sometimes there's a joke that the lesson that the environmental historians are bringing to the war was that the war was fought outside. Just a little bit of a reminder that environment really is important. It's both obvious and important, and yet so often overlooked. It's really great.
You know, it's funny because I love that line, and I laughed at it the first time I read it. But when I thought about it, it's actually a really interesting insight. I know it sounds really simple, but I don't necessarily know that we think about, as we study war, as we read about it in our offices, in our libraries, in the archives, that we think about the sheer physical effort of being outside all the time, and the sheer physical environmental experience of being outside all the time. It's not an experience that most of us have these days. And so that sort of idea that these armies are not going back to their hotels at night to settle in with a lovely beverage. They're outside the whole time, and just the sheer experience of that is really quite an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, for sure. And we do, with World War I, we talk about the trenches, or the trenches are perhaps more famous, but certainly with the Civil War, some of these environments are forbidding. I mean, you and I are both in the Washington, D.C. area, and if you go to some of these Civil War battlefields, either in this area or even, you know, further south, depending on the day you go, even being out there for a few hours can be pretty unpleasant. So just imagining the longer period of time that these soldiers are outside and the conditions and movement and what they're wearing and all those kinds of things should be a reminder, but it's not always, as you say.
Yeah, and it's also a form of its own form of memorialization, in the sense that a lot of these places, certainly the trench systems in World War I, the trenches around Petersburg, are still visible, are still present, have still shaped the landscape. And so we're used to the more normal kind of ways in which humans shape the landscape around them. And so these are sort of these kind of amazing leftovers, monuments to the war, that were not deliberately created or planned, but nonetheless are still incredibly evocative.
Yeah, absolutely. Connoisseur, I'll turn to you now.
I really thought that Kathleen Thompson's essay on mental trauma was a really strong contribution to this volume. I really enjoyed, and I learned a lot reading that piece. And I use it as an example of people looking back at the past and not thinking that there's any lesson to learn. Which is to say, they had a very difficult time connecting. They simply never connected wartime trauma with manifesting itself in a psychological way in a human body. It's not until Vietnam that we get post-traumatic stress disorder. It takes over a century after the Civil War. But there's this belief that by the army doctors during the Civil War, that they're seeing more people with mental issues, not because they're encountering some of the most horrific scenes ever seen on North American soil, but simply because they were had this effect on them already, right? So their poor qualities, they were people of poor morals, that it's all personal. That it's all internal. It's all dependent on the person's will. It's their responsibility. And it's not living a good life that makes them susceptible to these mental illnesses and whatnot. And so by the time of the Second World War, although there's the British and the French come up with shell shock, there's still this disconnect between, oh, it's being in the trenches. It's seeing these horrors of war that are causing this pain and suffering on this level. So it's just, again, as I said, it's an example of not learning the right lesson, not thinking there's a lesson to learn of what war does to the human body, not just physically, but also psychologically. I'll also point out that this essay really got me to think about, or added to, one of our other contentions in the volume, that there is a long 19th century, that the end of the Great War is the end of the 19th century that punctuates that time period. And it's because of this phenomenon that there's a sense of humans as being responsible for their mental well-being, that one should not be dependent, that one should be able to have this strong sense of moral character and go into war and come out being perfectly normal and whatnot. And there's no sense that one is there are other forces involved. It's not until the Great Depression, when such a vast proportion of the American population realize that there is perhaps a need for a safety net, for government intervention, that no matter how hard you work, sometimes the circumstances, the environment are against you. You can't just rely on the individual all the time. It's the shift in the mindset. And that takes place after World War I that helps set up for the post-World War II period with the government safety net and GI Bill and all that. That's more acceptable also because of this collective national trauma that people went through during the Great Depression. So it's the shift in understanding of how human beings function. And I think that Kathleen does a really good job of describing all that to our readers.
Yeah, she really does. And I found it interesting the way she talked about how in each of those wars, and I imagine there's a couple more one could do this with, where she talks about how for the military, there is some initial effort at treatment, but really the goal there is to get the soldier back onto the battlefield. And thus they're having to learn, or as you put it more accurately, are not learning the lesson several times over. And it won't be, as you say, until Vietnam for the lesson to really sink in. And it may still need to be occasionally learned again, even going forward from there. So we've taken a lot of your time. I thought as a conclusion to this great discussion and really fabulous book that I might ask you what I hope will be a fun question to say, are there other wars that you think haven't been put in conversation and should be put in conversation? Or are these two that are unique in the value, despite not having regularly been spoken about together by historians?
You're trying to get us to write another book, aren't you? You're,
yes.
I see where this is going. Yeah, mm-hmm. I read your ploy there. I don't know what a kid would say, but I would identify a particular category of wars. I think one of the things the United States doesn't like to think about is that most of our wars have actually been asymmetric wars against much smaller, usually non-white enemies, and not the kind of conventional battlefield wars that we think about, but guerrilla warfare, insurgencies. And every time we fight one of those, we're sort of shocked that this is happening to us. And then we promptly forget it as much as possible. It's happening right now with Afghanistan, where the military is happily turning back to what it calls large-scale combat operations with China. We don't like, as a nation, we don't like these kind of insurgency wars. And so even though we get sucked into them with a great frequency, we try to forget about them as soon as possible. And that's just something we should really actually be thinking about and researching and understanding.
Yeah.
I think the military historian has the edge on this answer. I'll take David's answer.
That sounds good. Well, thank you both so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. And again, I enjoyed the book and I hope that our listeners will pick it up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine.